From Economics Matters by Lawrence Kotlikoff. Does private credit / equity threaten the life insurance industry and your individual policy? I'll immediately make it a free lifetime subscription! Exclamation paid subscriptions come with a 1-hour free financial consultation with me. Email me a time at email redacted. Teaching financial literacy / economics in high school, college, or grad school. Contact me at email redacted for free MaxiFi licenses for your students and a PRO license for you. If you've been watching / listening to my podcasts, you're familiar with Fred Lane, founder, CEO, and CIO of Lane Generational. Fred's a storied investor and frequent Economics Matters podcast guest. His last appearance was in October. Fred's brilliant partner, Jack Skibley, is the COO and Director of Investment Strategy and Research at Lane Generational and a terrific economist. Jack just posted a long newsletter entitled Q1 26, The Illiquid Jenga Tower. I provide a summary below. Full disclosure, I invest with Fred and Jack, but I'm not a financial advisor and I don't recommend any investments of any kind, including Lane Generational, to anyone. Nor do I have any commercial relationship with Lane Generational apart from being an investor. Lane Generational is an SEC-registered investment advisor. The firm manages money on an active basis for investors seeking to grow and protect purchasing power through market cycles. Click here for their terrific free blog. Jack's blog involves the highly opaque and increasingly troubled private equity and private credit sectors. Jack, as you'll read, is concerned with the life insurance industry's heavy investment in these securities and the potential for losses in these sectors to bankrupt some / many / most life companies. Why should you care? Your life insurance company may be one of those that fail. If so, the problems in the private equity and private credit sectors will land in your lap. To be concrete, suppose you have, say, a $3 million life insurance policy to protect your spouse and kids and you drop dead at the same time your insurance company drops dead. Your heirs will likely end up with just $250,000 to $500,000, assuming state insurance commissions, which have de minimis reserves, come across to their pledged extent. Jack starts with a multi-decade shift of pension funds, university and other nonprofit endowments, and recently, life insurers into non-traditional investments, private equity, hedge funds, real estate, and of late, private credit. Take endowments. An astonishing 3/5 of their investments now comprise holdings of opaque private equity, real assets, and hedge funds. In 1988, this share was less than 5%, with 95% invested in publicly traded stocks and bonds, securities subject to second-by-second market valuation and public, if far from perfect, disclosure. This shift was inspired by the strategy of fabled Yale University investor David Swensen. Swensen focused on capturing the illiquidity premium from investing in illiquid assets. He earned a roughly 3 percentage point above market return between 1985 and 2001. Swensen might just have been lucky, but his strongly titled book, Pioneering Portfolio Management, convinced his peers to follow en masse. From the perspective of finance, finding new assets that aren't, like crypto, arguably dominated, is a bonanza path to higher returns with the same risk. But that presumes one knows the risk of the newly discovered assets. Jack stresses that the risk of these equity-like return-producing assets has been artificially undermeasured. Their performance is revalued on a quarterly, not a continuous, trading market basis, and security values are rarely properly marked down, declared to have fallen in real time. The accountants here are investment managers and for-hire independent appraisers who use highly manipulable performance measures, specifically adjusted EBITDA, as well as net asset value NAV appraisals based on cherry-picked price earnings multiples that have exploded over the past decade. This produces seemingly smooth returns when such smoothness is the product of accounting, not actual market purchases and sales. When underlying public market multiples fall, particularly in software and other growth sectors, private equity managers face a stark choice: crystallize much lower values through genuine exits or maintain inflated marks valuations of their private equity fund assets using devices like continuation funds, which mostly move assets from one pool of limited partners to another at or near stated net asset value. Jack references S&P research showing that the private equity sector's EBITDA addbacks special adjustments that raise EBITDA account for more than half of reported EBITDA. This lowers reported leverage ratios and raises reported, that is, estimated enterprise values. To understand continuation funds, suppose persons A and B hold assets worth X that they report are worth Y, where Y is far higher than X, A can sell his or her assets to B, and B can sell his or her assets to A both at price Y. This allows A and B to report, indeed prove, based on market transactions, that their assets are worth Y when they are only worth X. Jack calls the industry's valuation practices a Jenga tower built to collapse based on specious modeling assumptions and inter-industry transactions. Here's Jack's description. The typical leveraged buyout LBO model deployed by private equity is to purchase a company using a significant portion of debt, often 50-70%, backed by the target company's assets, then cut costs, increase cash flow to pay down debt, and attempt to sell at a higher multiple. How did private, as in undisclosed and arbitrarily valued, IOUs grow to today's $2 trillion market total? Arguably, the largest driver of success in this model is a declining interest rate environment, as debt used can be financed at cheaper rates, and lower rates also push up exit multiples. The era of declining interest rates ended in 2022, and since then, private equity has struggled, uncovering many fundamental issues masked by low rates. Financing activity then shifted to non-banks, including broadly syndicated loans BMSL investment banks underwrite and sell to institutions, collateralized loan obligations CMLOs bundling hundreds of individual loans into a single vehicle, and early direct lending funds, for example Ares, Blue Owl. Historically, private equity would source the debt used in an LBO from a traditional bank. But post-2008 reforms like Dodd-Frank and Basel Roman III regulated banks into maintaining higher capital ratios, making it less profitable to hold these types of leveraged loans on their books. However, with the immense scale of capital flowing into private equity, lending grew commensurately, to the point that large private equity firms, for example, Apollo, KKR, Blackstone, decided to open their own private credit arms to fund their investments. The same companies are now managing the debt and the equity, collecting fees on both, and heavily influencing valuation marks. Let's pause on the above paragraph. If I'm running a private equity fund and realize its assets aren't what I claim, borrowing to stay afloat by issuing an IOU that's backed by those self-same overvalued assets is engaging in fraud squared. And if my lenders realize my assets aren't worth what I'm claiming, they will pull their loans, forcing me to sell my assets in a rush, leading to very low market valuation. There are now huge PE funds serving as both the borrower and the lender in many of the same deals. According to Jack, 81% of private credit managers also manage private equity funds. Of course, traditional banks borrow money, including in the form of demand deposits, which they invest in assets, including equities. The difference here is that the banks are regulated and restricted with respect